Man, we don't live in Friday Fielder's universe. They have to live in the reality of with me of that's still monotonous and synchronized and old school, and I still have that grandson of a coach, son of a coach mentality to me, and that Japanese baseball influence. And so, yes, we do a lot of creative and innovative things, but at its root, I'm very, very reliant on repetition.
Welcome to Ahead of the Curve. This is your host, Jonathan Gellner. Today's show features Cleveland Indians minor league infield instructor, Kai Correa. If you follow social media at all, then you know that Kai is one of the best infield coaches in the country, and he's also the founder of hashtag Friday Fielders. On today's show, we go through what progressions he teaches, how they work defense in a team setting, and how to run practice indoors, which we all need this time of year. He also gives us his five things that we need to add to our infield practice that we don't practice enough. And just as a side note, we recorded this conversation earlier this fall, so when we're discussing group play and activities, keep in mind that Kai was still coaching in college and not with the Indians. Let's get right into the show, and I know you're going to love this conversation with Kai Correa. Coach Correa, thank you for joining us on Ahead of the Curve.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your background and tell us how you got your start in coaching.
Yeah, so grew up in Hilo, Hawaii, and I was the grandson and son of longtime coaches at uncles who coached and cousins who coached at various levels, be it youth and high school. And so grew up around coaching. And so obviously you kind of get that itch. Children of firemen want to be firemen. Children of cops want to be cops. And children of coaches, sons of coaches, oftentimes, if they have good experiences, want to be coaches. And that was the case for me. Went off to college and played Division III baseball at the University of Puget Sound in Tacoma, Washington, and had a great experience there. And while I was there during some summers, I kind of accidentally stumbled into some summer coaching positions, 15, 16, and 18U, and loved those. And the original plan was law school. My former head coach there in college, Brian Billings, offered me a job to become his infield coach and recruiting guy halfway through my senior season. And I jumped to it, kind of went into it blind, not knowing any idea what it was going to be like to coach at the college level. But I just knew that that's what I wanted to do for a living, and fell in love with it. And here we are, eight seasons later.
Okay. So let's hop into the practice segment. Now I've seen you and you've put out a ton of stuff on social media. You've given a lot of talks. And everything that I feel like you do is just innovative and really just really, really good. So talk to us about what you guys do in the fall. So what does a typical week look like for you? And where do you guys start? Like, what's your foundation?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So the funny thing is you talk about innovative and fun and stuff. And that's all I put out there because that's what people like. And my guys always laugh, and we always bring this up at practice, the infielders. They're like, man, we don't live in Friday Fielder's universe. They have to live in the reality of with me of that's still monotonous and synchronized and old school. And I still have that grandson of a coach, son of a coach mentality to me, and that Japanese baseball influence. And so, yes, we do a lot of creative and innovative things. But at its root, just starting from a fall, from both a team and an infield standpoint, I'm very, very reliant on repetition and discipline and really rigid drills that are almost robotic out of the gate, nauseating, and things that seem rudimentary. But the modern high school player comes to college pretty ill prepared. You know, he plays a ton of travel ball. He might play on a different fall team to a club team to a high school team. And so the bulk of his baseball career over the last 4 or 5 years has been built around exposure and not necessarily things like cuts and relays or bunt coverages or base running, these kind of nuanced things. And so from an infield specific standpoint, out of the gates, we are really focusing on how do you catch the baseball? How do you field the baseball? Where do you exchange the baseball? How do you throw the baseball? And once I feel like we have a really, really firm foundation to stand upon, that's when the fun begins. But I am not going to throw you into a creative, max effort, max speed, high intensity game-like reactionary drill competition and expect you to be able to swim. You know, I really want to equip guys with the tools and the different golf clubs to manage all the shots they're going to face, and then kind of go from there. And so all about the foundation out of the gates.
So take us through what that looks like.
Yeah. So right out of the gates in the fall, the first thing we're focusing on is catch play. And so we do a lot of catch play stuff and assign tasks and rows to both the thrower and the receiver at every distance. We do that synchronized together. Guys are partnered up and they have a firm understanding of what each drill is supposed to achieve. Essentially, what I've tried to design are things that are game-like and things that mirror game-like actions from three parts. The catch or the containment, which is something you do anytime a ball is thrown, hit towards you, whether it's on the ground, on a line, or in the air. The exchange, part two, and you know the varying ways we exchange the baseball and the varying directions we have to exchange the baseball, and then the throw itself, and in terms of the slot, the timing, the arm path, and then the intent and accuracy. That's kind of the start. We do a lot of catch play stuff out of the gates and spend a decent amount of time on that, just because being able to play catch is such the kind of pillar of playing defense. From there, we spend a lot of time on group catch, and I've talked a lot about this both ABCA and other podcasts, and just the idea that in a game, we rarely ever redirect the baseball in the direction where it comes from. And so tandem catch or partner catch promotes that a ton, and so I like putting us in groups. So you're kind of working on catch play with a varying number of people at varying angles, just like how the ball is thrown around in the game. In addition to that, I like group catch because it only involves one ball, and so does the game. And so lots of times when you have drills where you have 6, 7, 8 balls out there, people can hide in the numbers and hide their failures in the crowd, where when you go into a drill where the group has to function as one organism and there's only one ball to take care of, it makes the stakes feel higher. It makes errors feel more costly, just like they are in the game. After catch play and after group catch play, I do a ton of dry work. And that's just kind of the basic posture and mechanics to fielding a ground ball and the variety of different hops, be it short and rolling snakes and long hops and high hops. And so we kind of go through a dry work routine that promotes the varying glove movements, whether they're forward or backwards, to contain the baseball. And then kind of roll that back into the same exchange point we worked on catch play, and then the same throwing position we worked on catch play. So those kind of groups tie together. From there, we spend a lot of time on what I call transition drills or footwork drills, just helping to establish some rhythm, some direction, some momentum, have kind of inputting really distinct footwork patterns. And then from there, we wrap days up with live reps, just a massive amount of ground balls from a hack, from a fungo hitter, from myself, a road, with a variety of different angles and throws. And essentially how I break up the distribution of reps is pretty simple. The farther away we are from outside competition, the more, the percentage of reps, is based in drills and technique. And then the closer we are to competition, the more that the day seems free flowing and reactionary and game like, and the more the larger percentage of time we spend just completing reps, and the less time we do on drills. We use the drills more as warm ups.
Okay, I've got a couple of questions regarding the last couple of things that you said. And by the way, I'm glad that you mentioned the certain percentages, because I feel like we want everything to be so game like. But at the same time, we want to have a strong foundation of everything that we're working on. Is that kind of what you're thinking as well?
Yeah. And it's kind of weird, because the trend now in baseball is the concept that if we do things with maximum intent, that the body's going to reorganize itself, right? We're seeing that in modern hitting training, where, you know, we're trying to smash the ball and lift that, lift the ball in the air and swing hard, and we're trying to throw hard. And that, I think, holds true. That intense style of learning and that task-oriented learning holds true for hitting and pitching. But defense is such a different act to me. And I think that if I take a fielder and I purely just put him on a stopwatch or throw a radar gun at him and I make him do the acts as hard as they possibly can, I don't know that he necessarily gets better in the right ways or at the same rate that you do when performing that for pitching and for hitting. And so my thought process is I eventually want to get to that point when we're focused around the stopwatch, when we're focused around the clock and going at a really fast clip. But I think the foundation has to be built first, where you have really, really good baseline actions, and then we can go to promote versatility and athleticism and intent.
I love it. So the drills that you mentioned earlier about your catch play and your group catch play and the dry work, do you guys do those every day?
Yeah, and we do them every single day, just different varieties. So I prescribe a specific catch play routine, group catch play drill, and dry work routine, both kneeling and standing, from a week-to-week standpoint. So from a Monday through a Thursday, they'll do the same one, and then going into the next week, there'll be an alteration, whether it's there's a component that's now barehanded, whether there's a component that now involves a training glove, whether there's a component that, you know, involves a specific task post field where we're going to rhythm tap and double tap with our gloves, or shuffle twice, or shuffle once, or don't shuffle at all, whether we're going to throw exclusively out of one arm slot for one drill. So those things I change from a week to week standpoint, so that it still instills that discipline and that uniformity, but at the same time, it creates versatility where after 4 weeks, you've done one task four different ways.
Let's say that I went to a new school and I tried to, and I was an infield coach. So how would I sell the kids on really just breaking it down to fundamentals, almost stuff that you do, you know, in Little League? Because I know high school kids are like, oh, we're too cool for stuff like that, which, you know, handle it however you want. But it sounds like you've got these kids completely bought in to doing the boring stuff every single day. Now, how did you get to that point?
I think it's coming from like an elite fielder legitimacy, right? Everything that I've kind of developed is centered around elite fielders that we see at the college level and film of elite professional fielders. And so I try to explain it in a way that's not overly wordy, that's not overly technique driven. I just try to name the drills and name the tasks after good fielders. And so it kind of has that professional ethos that, hey, this is a move that Arenado does. This is a move that Vizquel does. This is a move that Jeter did. And we're trying to promote that move. And I think from there, the modern athlete has that buy-in. And I think the other way I explain this thing is breaking it down is that these guys have spent hundreds and thousands of dollars in their life getting hitting and pitching lessons where they did front toss and tee work and weird drills and breakdowns. And they only practice defense from a rep standpoint. And so I'm kind of selling it as like almost like the private lesson model for development of infielders.
I'm all in on that. I know that if you mentioned a Jeter play, and I know that's not your basic fundamental play, but just by naming it the Jeter play, everybody's like, man, I'm all in on that. So that's cool.
Yeah. And it reminds them of the functionality, right? Like that's the thing is if you just say, hey guys, we're going to go out here and study calculus. And then someone asks you, how the hell am I going to use this in my life when I'm 40? That's tough, right? But if I say, hey, we're going to get on our knees and we're going to work on this specific glove move, and in the game, you're going to encounter X amount of hops that are like this, okay, that seems more practical, right? The other thing is I have no problem pointing out my guys' flaws, like reminding them that they were imperfect when they walked in the door, that fielding percentage is one of the things that is drastically different from professional to college, from college to high school, and from high school to youth league. Like, you know, that's something that you do at a 750 clip, an 800 clip, a 900 clip, all the way, you know, it's a far road to 980, to 975, to 970. And so I have no problem reminding them of how many holes there are in their game, especially a lot of them that relied on their athleticism. And so, you know, it's just part of the process to me.
Well, switching gears a little bit, and something that I like to really integrate or try to integrate almost every practice, and that's some sort of competition, whether it be punishment at the end with like one push up or just something simple as just trying to get them to compete and anything really. So how do we get our kids more competitive from an infield side? Do you have any drills or do you just have any practical ways to do that?
For me, I do it from an individual standpoint in just terms of sheer intensity and pace, in terms of the pace and the fact that I'm loud, I'm in your face, that I point out every little mistake and every little success. And so I try to foster a really, really intense and competitive infield, daily infield practice environment just by holding people to, you know, unfairly high standards, right? So that's one major thing in terms of integrating competition is that I want them to be in competition with themselves to be perfect, right? The only way we're going to field at a really high clip and win games is if We don't say, oh, well, that was a bad hop. Oh, gosh, I just let that one slip. Oh, oops, I just dropped the exchange. It was just that one time, right? And I try to remind guys that one time, right? You may get 400-500 reps today, and you might miss five and feel good about that clip, but you might get five in the game. And what if those are the five out of the 500 you missed today, right? And so I think that the game-like intensity is an important part in that. And I know that doesn't necessarily answer your question, but it's an important piece to me because I'm always careful about how much I need competition because that tells me I'm coaching the wrong guys, right? If I need to have a carrot, you know, or a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, that scares me. I think I want the desire to be good to be enough to drive you to be competitive at practice. In terms of the actual competition, going back to your original question, I think you can assign points to things really easily, right? It's a point for a clean catch. It's a point for a clean exchange. It's a point for an accurate throw. It's a point 3-point play. It's a point, you know, 2 points if you do it's less than 3.9 seconds. It's 1 point if it's under 4.2. It's no points if it's under 4.3. It's minus 1 point if it's 4.3 to 4.5. You know, I think having a creative scoring system and breaking down different components in each of the components of the infield play is a really, really fun way that an amateur fielder can start learning the value of each parts of the defensive practice.
Awesome. So just as you're going through that, I'm just imagining an infield the entire time. And so for our listeners out there who get past the dry reps and the dry runs and they want to put them out on the team in their position, so how does each position get a ton of reps?
That's simple to me. I think that we should always avoid the single fungal hitter going around the diamond and having that downtime. I think you can manage rep quantity by assigning other tasks to other positions. So let's say if I'm striking ground balls to the shortstop and I can have him be assigned to both field and flip to the second baseman. I can have the second baseman be assigned to working on his footwork around the bag, but just getting to the power position without making throws. I can have a ball out there with the third baseman, and they can be working on catching and tagging, you know, theoretical throws from the outfield, both, you know, long hops, short hops, throws on the fly, deking, like the ball's not coming and tagging late. Meanwhile, I can have an extra ball out there with the first baseman, and they can work on stretching and picking from different angles, right? And I can bang through a whole bucket like that, then shift gears. Then I can hit to the third baseman, and they can be firing across to the first baseman. So the third baseman's task is field and throw. The first baseman's task is stretching and catching. From there, the second baseman and the shortstop can be working together on catching and tagging, throwing balls together as if they're throwdowns from the catcher from behind the mound. Or they can be working on potential relay throws where they toss the ball in the air and they work on, you know, catching at the right spot and exchanging the baseball quickly and setting their feet to different bases. So I think that's a really big key to maximizing reps is make sure, you know, that you're not hitting to more. I try not to hit to more, have one fungal hitter machine hit or feed to more than two position groups at a time. And I want the other two position groups to either be with an additional fungal hitter or be off on their own handling a task and then just move those around the diamond.
So in each of those, you mentioned a tag component. And I know that I used to teach infield or I used to coach infield, but that's something that I probably didn't do enough. Is that something that you try and work on a lot?
Yeah, there's a couple plays that I feel like we don't do enough, right? So the first thing is I think the average infield practice, if you look at it, it probably involves some picks. And so, but they only do short hops. They don't do multiple hops. And then in addition to that, it probably involves some ground balls. In actuality, infielders, they acquire outs in so many different ways throughout the course of the game. In fact, like at the major league level, I think they catch an infield fly ball for every four ground balls they get. But there's no way we hit fly balls at that same rate to our guys. So the tasks that I like to include every single day in practice are some element of stretching and catching, regardless of position, some element of stretching and picking, regardless of position, some element of catching infield fly balls, going back on fly balls, some element of picking and tagging, and then some element of redirection. So catching a ball and then redirecting in a new direction. And so I try to do all of those in addition to fielding ground balls on a daily basis.
That's something that I probably did a disservice to my kids that that I was teaching before. So you're really stretching my infield mind. So I really appreciate that. That's awesome.
No problem. Yeah, I did the same. And I think there's so many guys out there that just think infield practice is banging ground balls. And that, you know, all of a sudden there's a man on first base, somebody bumps the ball right in front of the plate and he fires to the second base and the shortstop's not, he's stretching with the wrong foot. And he comes in the dugout and you're yelling at him, hey, you know, why can't you, what are you doing? Why are you using the wrong foot? Why didn't you stretch right? This, that, and the other. And you don't realize, hey, I never asked you to do that in a practice format.
No, that's good. I'm sure I'm guilty of that as well. And if we haven't taught it in a practice, we can't expect them to do it in a game. No, that's great.
Not by any means.
So talk to us about, and this is a question that I ask a lot. It's a question that always comes up whenever you're talking to other coaches. So what do you guys do for team building or leadership building activities?
Yeah. In terms of leadership specifically, that's a really, really important thing for me in the infield. You know, I think that the old school baseball thought process, and catching guys won't like me saying this, was that catchers are, you know, the captain of the defense and they call things out. But that's changed drastically with people calling pitches for catchers and just kind of the role of the catcher in general. And so I think that anybody who stands in the middle of the diamond can have a leadership role. And it's just based on baseball IQ and assertiveness and age. And so I really, really want to empower my old guys to provide input on the drills, input on the practice planning. So one thing I do in terms of leadership standpoint, I partner the old with the young. So when we're doing catch play, when we're doing picks, when we're doing footwork patterns, it's always an old guy and a young guy, or an old guy and a new guy, a veteran, a returnee, and a new guy, right? And they're constantly kind of giving each other feedback throughout the course of the drill. In addition to that, I kind of talk one-on-one with my returning infielders on a weekly basis and kind of say, hey, how'd you feel about the new drills? How'd you feel about the old drills? Are guys getting it? Are people getting worse? Because we have to admit it, coaches, that sometimes you can have a drill, you could have a cue that makes three of your infielders better and one of your guys worse. And so and they're not willing to tell that, especially if I'm 18 years old, I'm not going to tell that to the coach, right? I might kind of whisper that in the ear of the other first baseman, like, hey, I'm really confused what's going on. And so I kind of want to have that constant dialogue. And I think that builds leadership and it also builds ownership where they're the ones, you won't have guys kind of complaining about a drill or misunderstanding a cue if they're your important infielders are the one who's asked for it. That's what I try to do. I really want to empower the older infielders who've been through the cycle of drills and the cycle of cues to pick the ones they like the most and provide me feedback when they think that something's working or not working. And you got to be realistic enough as a coach to take that input and not as a criticism to your ability. We have to be more versatile. And we have to be willing to hear what they're saying and come up with something new to get the same result. Because we don't coach to be good at drill design. We coach to be good at player development and eventually win games. And so if my drill isn't working, I have to acknowledge that I'm going to take a loss if I'm unwilling to change that.
Oh, that's perfect. I know that we get a lot more buy-in when we explain what we're doing, and it sounds like you do a great job of that.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, that's the one thing. I got a lot of old school in me, you can call me new agey or millennial when it comes to the fact that I have no problem having that, you know, that dialogue with my guys. And I think that if you're not willing to have a dialogue with your players on why you're doing something, you probably need to look pretty hard in the mirror to see is that a weakness? Are you afraid that what you're doing is just something you're comfortable with and it might not be right or the best?
Okay, so we went through the fall. Well, actually, I want to know, what do you guys do whenever it snows outside? How do you guys get infield work indoors?
I used to work with a guy at an indoor facility, and thankfully, I'm from Hilo, so it's one of the rainiest cities in the Western Hemisphere, right? And then I lived in the Seattle-Tacoma area for 9 years. So places with heavy precipitation. I've got a lot of indoor time in my background. And so that's where that creativity comes in. And infield is something you can improve really in a small space, right? I used to work with a guy at an indoor facility who says, hey, you can teach infielders in the back of a van, right? And when you take away throws, you can do basically everything else an infielder does, you know, inside the space of, you know, four phone booths. Not much changes because I'm such a strong believer in the foundation of the moves, the catch, the contain, the field, the exchange, the throwing position. I think you can do those all in an indoor. And I think one of the biggest problems that a lot of people have in indoors is they say, hey, you know, if you can't make field a full length ground ball and you can't make a full length throw, you're not getting better. And I don't agree. First of all, I think a shorter distance ground ball is more difficult and better training for a full length ground ball because you're shortening the reaction time and you're speeding up the decision making process. In addition to that, the lack of the full length throw or the lack of the throw at all shouldn't be a reason that you become poor at the throw. I think the exchange, your footwork post field, and the power position have as much to do with the throw itself, especially in terms of its accuracy. And so I think one beef I have with a lot of folks is that they allow guys to field ground balls on non-throwing reps, whether it's in an indoor or in a confined space, and they just stand up straight. They let them go erect. They let them drop the ball in the bucket. And then later on, they claim that those reps weren't valuable. Just because you're indoors doesn't mean you can't police the quality of rep and the quality of moves your athletes make post field. And so that's something we really harp on, and that's something how we take advantage of our, what we use to take advantage of our space.
So what's the first thing you guys start with, and then take us through the spring? Do you guys change anything, or does most everything stay the same?
So we try to dive right back into the drill work, but we just kind of go at a faster clip. Just the idea that, hey, we're going to still do dry work, catch play, and footwork every day, but instead of taking 15 minutes, let's have it take 7 minutes. And let's have it take 8 minutes total. And as the spring evolves, as I stated earlier, the closer we are to competition, the more we're doing reps, the less we're doing drills. As we go into spring, it's a pretty massive distribution of drills. And I just, you know, it depends if we're playing on the road or at home, but I want to make sure my guys get everything they need in terms of receiving throws down, catching fly balls, exchanging baseballs, and then taking a ton of ground balls, both of the forehand, the backhand, the conventional, and the slow roller variety, and then making throws to the different bases. So that's kind of what the spring looks like. The spring is a lot more game-like reps. And then sprinkled into the spring is I try to do something that's a little bit more fun here and there, whether that's a game or a competition. Play some turf tennis, do a pop fly day where you got to catch three consecutive mammoth Hackatech fly balls in a row, you know, at the same time, or things like that. Just try to loosen it up, just remembering that those games are pretty intense days, both physically and mentally. And so I want those days in between to be both instructive but refreshing.
So I forgot to ask this earlier. How much time do you guys use for catch play, group catch, and then your basic fundamentals whenever you guys are starting?
So on a given day, we allot somewhere between 45 minutes and an hour of practice time, team practice time to individual defense. So the catch play, dry work, footwork all happens in that. So I'd say at the start of fall, you're probably looking at 20 to 25 minutes of that time built around the drills, around the catch play, around the group catch, and around the footwork. And then probably 20 to 25 minutes of that time built around reps. As we get into the spring, you're probably looking at more only of 10 to 15 minutes worth of drills.
And then you guys will go into like your team setting drills?
Yes. So every day in terms of basic practice design, post-stretch, there's some element of individual defense. Then there's some element of team defense. Then there's some element of team offense. And then mass hitting, bullpens, things like that. And then into finishing up with some base running element.
And just so I can get this right in my mind, you're talking about like cuts and relays would be like one team element, and first and third defense would be like one team element, things like that.
Yeah, and so I have like a drill bank basically for both individual defense and team defense, and I just kind of make sure I hit into them. So cuts and relays, tandem cuts, pop fly communication, bunt defense, first and third defense, holding runners at second, PFPs, picks, rundowns. All of those things kind of go into one box, and then I try to hit each of them once a week, once every 2 weeks. Again, with the modern athlete, in terms of attention span, I try not to do the lengthy, drawn-out team defensive sessions, the old school, hey, we're going to have to make 27 outs in a row here. Mm-hmm. That's not realistic. In the game, if you make an error in the first, the game doesn't restart. You got to move on. You know, and I try to have my drills not be like that. In terms of instilling competition, you had asked me about that earlier. I think I like doing that more in team defense than I do in individual defense, right? Like I said, I want you to be competitive as an individual already. I don't have to use points to get that out of you. But in terms of team defense, I think we do that really slow paces and overly explanatory ways. And so I want that to happen fast. Instead of having pitchers run the bases and somebody put down bunts, we actually have a team bunting whose objective is to advance people 90 feet. And we have a team out there on defense trying to complete our bunt plays. And so we definitely try to do all those team defensive elements against a live offense.
So something you mentioned earlier and something that I do a terrible job of is holding runners at second. So can you help us out and give us some hacks with that?
In terms of some hacks for holding runners at second, I think if you start looking at how you hold runners at second with the idea that all you were trying to do is prevent them from stealing third, you're better off. I think people who try to look at holding runners at second as a way to acquire outs and pick people off are looking at something that happens at a very small percentage of time. Really, our goal is just to stop the running game. And so I think the idea is that you should design a system where both your infielders and your pitchers are accountable for stopping momentum. And as long as they're comfortable with the distance the runner is from second base and the momentum or lack thereof that he has, I think the pitch can be delivered. And so I think the pitcher's safeguard should be the inside move or stepping off. And I think the infielder's safeguard should be flashing to the bag. And if you have two people, both the infielder assigned to the bag for that at bat and the pitcher taking care of their responsibilities as kind of both as a safety valve for each other, I think that should be more than serviceable enough way to hold runners at second.
Perfect. Well, thank you for that. And I appreciate you going into some detail about that, because I know that I do not have a very easy time doing that. And it's tough to get kids to buy in to do that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, because this is what I thought. I grew up in the style of baseball. Here's the no-look pick. Here's the two-look pick. Here's the timing play. Here's the daylight, right? And then we use these like once every eight games, right? Once in a blue, and they work once every season. So it's like, was that 20 minutes every Tuesday for a whole year worth that one time? I don't know. You know, and some will argue, what if it was in a big situation? And my argument is the more important role is not letting that guy steal third base, right? And so if I can spend 5 minutes a week making sure that me and the pitcher are synced up to not allow the guy to steal third, that's something that I'm not going to do once a series. I'm going to do that once an inning, you know, once every inning, once every three innings. That's something that I'm not going to do once a season. It's something I'm going to end up doing hundreds of times throughout a course of 55 games. And so that's, to me, a more practical way to spend your time. Like you and I have talked about before, I do not want to practice anything at the same proportion that it doesn't occur in the game.
Sure. What's something that you once thought was an absolute or once thought was true, but you may have recently changed your mind about?
Yeah, a million different things. But I think the easiest thing to say, because I think there's still guys out there that believe this, I believe three things that I now would slap myself for. The first thing is that I thought every ball should be exclusively pressed through, played forward through with positive glove action when fielding a ground ball. The second thing is that I thought that you should never glove tap. That you should, you know, the taste takes up too much time. And the third thing I thought is that every throw should be deflected for the fastest exchange possible. And gosh, those things have blown up in my face. The press through thing, I realized, thankfully, you know, just from watching gameplay, and I was watching and counting the distribution of errors, and I was noticing that my guys were clanking balls on non-short hops, and it didn't make sense to me. I'm like, that ball's rolling on the ground, or that ball's chest high. Why are we not catching that? And I realized that every drill I'd done and every cue and every instruction for the entire season used to revolve on moving your glove forward. And on those plays, the glove didn't need to move forward. So they didn't know what to do. And so that's when it dawned on me. And I started watching film and I'm like, gosh, there is a lot of funnel. There is a lot of negative glove action that goes on when fielding the ball. And so I realized, gosh, a good infielder, he's got to be able to do both. He's got to be able to match plane with his glove, both forward and backwards. In terms of the glove tap, that bubble got burst for me, because it's one of those things that almost every pro does. So you're like, God, why am I saying you can't do that? Like it's illegal and banned in the United States. Why am I so hard about the glove tap when every big leaguer is doing it? Why does it make sense? And people would say, oh, they do it because guys don't run hard 90s. Oh, they do it because they have superior arm strength. And those things are wrong, because when I time 90s in Major League Baseball, if you move a guy to your right or your left, guys are hauling butt down the line. You get some pretty quick times home to first. The other thing is I saw guys glove tap on jump throws and diving plays. So it told me it wasn't something when they did when they thought they had a ton of time. And then the last thing is that I started noticing that when I forced guys into two-step alignments to get rid of the ball right away without the glove tap, we'd make more throwing errors. And then I started noticing that throwing errors are made at such a smaller rate at the professional level. And it's because the glove tap, the hand pump, helps guys to stay in rhythm. You know, and so that's how that bubble got bursted. And then the last thing, deflection, is something I taught exclusively. And a buddy of mine, Billy Boyer, is now the volunteer assistant at Seattle U. He and I had lengthy conversations about this over a course of years. And essentially, I bought in because ball security is so important. And the fact that you can move a ball with one hand faster than you can move a ball with two, it proved to me that it was both better in terms of efficiency and better in terms of speed. And that's something that Marty Lees always told me. He said, hey, when you're an infield coach, if someone says they can do something more efficient or faster, you have to be bought in. There's just no argument with efficient and fast. And I think that the idea of exclusively deflecting, that bubble got bursted when I realized that. And so those are the three primary things, for a 2 to 3 year span, 2 year span where I exclusively taught, that I've got away from.
Yeah. Well, I can't argue with those, and also can't argue with, Marty Lees about too much about infield play either.
This is true.
So is there maybe somewhere online that, let's say X coach wants to go find a ton of fielding video. Is there maybe a certain hashtag that comes out on a certain day on a couple of social media platforms that that they could go find?
Yeah, yep, absolutely. As you're implying, we got the Friday Fielders thing going on strong, and that's just not me. That's a lot of contributors, and that's how I love it, because people disagree and post contradictory things, and you can kind of make decisions for yourself. But if you search hashtag Friday Fielders on Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, there's a ton of content, 2 years worth of content actually now, of videos and clips and still frames, and you kind of sort through that for yourself. That's kind of a huge database of information.
So is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners before you go?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is sometimes when you come on here and you get to spew your thoughts on something, people can get the wrong idea that you think you got it all figured out. And I want to make sure people know that if I did a podcast 2 years from today, odds are I probably contradict some things I said in the last 55 minutes. And I think that that's the biggest thing is as long as you go about your craft knowing that you're probably screwing up in some capacity, then you're probably going to be getting better.
Thank you for listening to Ahead of the Curve. I would love to get in contact with you to hear your thoughts on the podcast. There are two easy ways to do that. You can email me at jgelner7@gmail.com or find me on Twitter at @AOTC_podcast. Also, do you like to share ideas and have conversations with other baseball coaches? Just go to facebook.com and search Ahead of the Curve Coaches to join our group. It's free, so what have you got to lose? If you're enjoying the podcast, please consider leaving a rating so others can find the show. Thanks for listening, and have a great week.